calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
One day after a New York investment group raised $110,000 for Republican Representative Jerry Lewis, writes USA Today in essentially a screaming headline on the front page, the House passed a defense spending bill that preserved $160 million for a Navy project critical to the very firm that raised the $110,000 for Representative Jerry Lewis. And who is the guy who protected the Navy money for this company? Republican Congressman Jerry Lewis. Gee, what a surprise! What a surprise. Duke Cunningham taking money and doing things. Lewis says he did nothing improper, right? It wasn't a bribe. It was just a campaign contribution. Democrats are saying, and Nancy Pelosi in particular, you know, outspoken on this, Barack Obama, that Republicans must be held accountable not only for the poison tree of corruption, but for the fruits of bad legislation that result. In other words, a whole bunch of bad laws have been passed. And boy, do we know about them. The so-called bankruptcy reform, the poison pill, and the Medicare legislation, and on the list goes, as a result of essentially bribery, this whole K Street project and all of this. Let us not forget, by the way, our eternal quote for the day. This should be heard every single day. As often as they played Howard Dean's Scream, they should be playing this.
There are no Democrats who took money from Jack Abramoff. Not one. Not one single Democrat. Every person named in this scandal is a Republican. Every person in under investigation is a Republican. Every person indicted is a Republican. This is a Republican finance scandal. There is no evidence that Jack Abramoff ever gave any Democrat any money. And we've looked through all those FEC reports to make sure that's true.
There you go. So, to discuss this with us, we have Robert Garmong of the Ayn Rand Organization, the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org. Robert, even yesterday on Lou Dobbs' program, Lou Dobbs, who is a dyed-in-the-wool conservative Republican, he's out about it, right? He's come out as a Republican. He proudly proclaims that he's been a Republican his whole life, said that he feels that the only way to clean this mess up is to have public financing of elections. Let's get the corporate money out of the election process. Your take on it? Robert?
Yes, well, I disagree entirely. I think, first of all, Tom, I think we have to keep a certain degree of perspective on what the real problem is. And it's been, there have been a couple of indictments and a guilty plea. So it's not clear that the problem is quite as widespread as it's been made out to be. But I think that what is going on right now is missing one crucial point, and that is that the First Amendment to the Constitution guarantees the right to petition the government. And I think that the whole lobbying system is part of the process, and I don't think that you can get lobbying and get money out of politics without violating the First Amendment right to petition the government.
But how do you define petition the government? I mean, does petition the government mean giving $110,000 to Jerry Lewis and the next day he inserts a piece, something into a piece of legislation that gives you $110 million? Is that petitioning the government? That sounds like bribery to me. Which, by the way, in the first draft of the Constitution, the impeachment clause originally had the word bribery in it. They later took it out and said, let's be more general and just talk about high crimes and misdemeanors. But in the first draft of the Constitution, it said the president can be impeached for bribery, high crimes, and misdemeanors.
That's right. And I think these terms are sometimes a bit fuzzy and hard to define. And I think that in any case where there's a difficult definition, one has to take the greatest latitude for liberties.
And why, if that produces the worst public policy, why do that?
Well,
why not take the choice that's going to be the best for the people of America?
Tom, I think we're really, what we're looking at here is a symptom of a much bigger problem, much deeper problem, and we keep trying to treat the symptom rather than the actual problem. And the problem is the fact that the government has taken on such power to control our lives and our liberties in the economic realm as well as in the personal realm. And I think that as long as we have a government that has this kind of overreaching authority over our lives and our economy, we are going to have, by one means or another, someone is going to find a way around whatever rules we try to put in place.
But in large part, Robert Garmong, what you're talking about from ayanrand.org, what you're talking about is, for example, the military-industrial complex that Dwight Eisenhower warned us about. We see, I mean, that's what Duke Cunningham was right in the middle of. We see defense contractors routinely giving large contributions to politicians, largely Republicans, but there's Democrats getting them as well, and those politicians then voting for things ranging from wars to defense systems of questionable value, apparently in exchange for this. Shouldn't we, I mean, in 1907, Teddy Roosevelt got a law passed through Congress that made it a felony for a corporation to give money to a politician. Shouldn't we simply go back to that?
Well, I don't think we should, and I think there is a profound difference between two concepts that sometimes get blurred in the public discourse, and that is between bribing someone and supporting someone who already supports your ideas and values. And I think bribery is clearly not a good thing to have in the public sphere, and I think that is rightly outlawed. But there should be nothing wrong with supporting someone who supports you, and I think that we can draw a distinction, and the examples that you're giving always do draw that sort of distinction implicitly, even though it gets blurred in the way people talk about the issue. It's wrong for someone to change a vote or to sell a vote, but I don't think it's wrong for a corporation or for any other private enterprise to support those who support their ideas and their goals and their values.
Why, Robert Garmong, should a corporation which does not have the right to vote be allowed to insert itself into our political process?
Well, I think that precisely the fact that it doesn't have the right to vote is one reason that it should have the means to push.
My dog doesn't have the right to vote. My cat doesn't have the right to vote. They're also not allowed to participate in politics.
But a corporation.
If I made a contribution in the name of my cat, which is actually a living, breathing animal, I could be prosecuted.
That detail.
But if I go out and I create a corporation tomorrow and make a contribution in the name of the corporation, no problem. It's separate from me somehow. It's different.
That's right. But corporations do have interests that are directly affected by legislation continually, as do labor unions, as do any number of different sorts of collective organizations.
And let the people in those corporations and those labor unions and those churches and all those other kinds of organizations where people come together, let those individuals participate in the political process. I mean, the fundamental reality here, Robert, is that in, for example, labor unions, because labor unions are democracies, they do elect their leadership. In the vast majority of cases, when labor unions support a candidate, it's because the majority of the actual union members support that candidate. On the other hand, you've got corporations out there who are supporting candidates where the vast majority of the employees of the corporation would have nothing to do with that candidate if it was up to them.
That certainly is a possibility, but the corporation has been defined, at least by the Supreme Court, as in certain respects a person under the law, and I think it does have the right to promote its interests in the public sphere. And as long as, again, we're getting away from my main point, which is that as long as the government has usurped the power to regulate our lives, our persons, our liberty, we are necessarily creating a situation in which people, out of mere self-defense, have a need to have lobbyists and...
Well, you said people. I thought we were talking about corporations.
Corporations are nothing but groups of people, Tom.
No, a corporation is a separate entity in and of itself. I'm suggesting that if the people who are employees of a corporation individually want to contribute to something, they should be entitled to. We the people. There should be no law that prevents we the people from petitioning for redress of grievances. I agree with the First Amendment in that regard. But that, you know, I don't think that a corporation is a person, particularly when it comes to our electoral process. And neither does the government, because they don't let corporations vote. A corporation can't walk into a voting precinct and cast a vote.
That's right, but I think that a corporation is, because companies are regulated so heavily by our government, it is absolutely necessary for them to have the means to fight back when they are commonly vilified and attacked in the press.
But if the people in a corporation believe that their corporation is doing the right thing and they like the corporation, they like the way it's run, they're going to vote in the interest of the corporation. They can make contributions in the interest of the corporation. Now, if on the other hand, the leadership of the corporation, a small, wealthy elite, is doing stuff that's screwing the people and screwing society, why should they have the right to walk into my senator's office and have actually more say than I do because they have more money?
Well, Tom, there's a well-known phenomenon that the obvious benefit to people will outweigh the less obvious benefit. And so people who have an interest may not recognize it, may not organize, may not go out and vote. And
so the average employee might just be too dumb, whereas the CEO knows what's best. I know that's not what you meant to imply. I'm sorry, it was a cheap shot, and we're out of time, and I don't want to make a cheap shot in my last comment. Robert Garmon, thanks for being with us. Ayn Rand, AYNRAND.org.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Have you seen the little piggies crawling in the dark?
No, it's really not the little piggies you have to worry about. It's the bigger piggies, the ones with the clean white shirts.
Always having dirt to play.
And here they come, the story of the bigger piggies. Indeed. Pick it up, Alex. There you go. It's the bigger piggies in their clean white shirts. Six former heads, and they're taking over Washington, D.C. now. Six former heads of the Environmental Protection Agency, five Republicans, and one Democrat. Get this. Agency heads during five Republican administrations, including the current one, criticized the Bush White House yesterday at an EPA meeting for what the Bush administration is failing to do with regard to global warming and other environmental problems. Even the guy who succeeded Ruckelshaus in the Nixon and Ford administrations, Russell Train, said slowing the growth of greenhouse gases isn't enough. He said, we need leadership, and I don't think we're getting it. This was Nixon's Republican EPA head. He said to sit back and just push it away and say we'll deal it down sometime down the road is dishonest to the people and self-destructive. At the same time, we see that 3,200 people are officially still missing 5 months after Hurricane Katrina. That's more than died in the World Trade Center. And we pretty assiduously looked for those folks. Where is Bush's righteous indignation on this? Well, you know, again, you go back to the global warming thing, the Bush administration doing nothing about global warming. Why? Because you've got a whole bunch of big oil industry, you know, dirty industries giving enormous amounts of money to the Republican Party and the Bush administration in particular. Why is nothing going on for the Katrina victims? They're not political donors. It's not Manhattan. They're not mostly affluent white folks like the folks, you know, not, well, let's tell the truth, like the folks who died in the Twin Towers. Although I think, frankly, that there was a larger element. I don't think that this is entirely a racial thing. I think there's a larger element of the fact that that was more spectacular, and it was in New York City, so it got a lot more press coverage. But and then you've got the Agriculture Department. There's all three stories here right in today's paper. The Agriculture Department has pretended to investigate anti-competitive behavior among stockyards and meat companies since 1999, but in hundreds of cases hasn't actually filed complaints, says an audit released Wednesday. Senior officials blocked investigations from being referred to department's lawyers. And these lawyers now are complaining to the Justice Department. In the meantime, employees were told to create the appearance of a high rate of enforcement by logging routine letters and reviews of public data as investigations. Now, why would the Bush administration's Agriculture Department pretend to investigate anti-competitive behavior among stockyards and meat companies instead of actually doing it? Could it have to do with the fact that a lot of money is being given to them? I'm telling you, public financing of elections is the only solution. The last election cycle, about $1 billion was spent at the federal level. For a four-year election cycle, House, Senate, presidency, the election of 2000, about $1 billion. Actually, I think the 2004 was a little was more than that. I think it was almost $2 billion. But let's go back to 2000. That was a well-fought campaign. $1 billion. You divide $1 billion by 300 million people. Well, let's divide it by 150 million employed people in the United States. Or roughly, I think it's 110 million people in the workforce, something like that. Say 100 million. Okay. $1 billion divided by 100 million is 100 bucks a person. Divide that by four, that's $25 a year. Are you willing to pay $25 a year to have no special interests whatsoever involved in politics? I am. I'd do it in a heartbeat. We're doing this here in the city of Portland, and it's working spectacularly, although now the special interests have come up with a ballot initiative to try and do away with the voter finance campaigns here in the city of Portland. But we have a mayor and four city commissioners who are not beholden to anybody except we the people. And Enron owns our power company here, and there's talk about the city deprivatizing it, taking it and making it a public utility. And so guess who is, you know, helping fund the program, or, you know, shall we say, shares the PR firm with the group that is working to do away with voter-funded elections here in Portland. Yeah, you got it. And as Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, not exactly the most liberal people in Congress, not bad. I mean, you know, neither one of them of the caliber of Nancy Pelosi. Well, Barack Obama, in my opinion, the jury's still out on. But in any case, as Senator Barack Obama said, this situation we have right now, he says, this means instead of meeting with lobbyists, it's time to start meeting with some of the 45 million Americans who have no health care. Instead of hitting up with the big firms on K Street, it's time to start visiting the workers on Main Street who are wondering how they'll send their kids to college or whether their pensions will still be around when they retire. Even though Congress is not in session right now, 75 House and Senate members turned up at the library's Great Hall, Library of Congress, filing into an orchestral piece called Heroism and signing a declaration committing them to honest leadership. Republicans mocked the event. And you know why? 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The True People's Radio.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Got no time for grand philosophy. I'll barely keep my head above the tide.
And welcome back, my friends, to the radio support group up by and for We the People of the United States of America, the Tom Hartman radio program. This hour's program brought to you by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS, smalldog.com, the website if you want to check it out. And welcome back to our program. Our telephone number, toll-free across the United States, 1-866-440-8466. Drop into our live chat room at tomhartman.com. However you spell it, we'll get you there. Just click the live chat link if you would like. And once again, 866-440-THOM, our telephone number. And Rachel in Seattle on the line. Hey, Rachel, what's up? I think.
Hi, Tom, smart man.
Smart man, oh, jeez. Hi, Rachel.
How are you today?
I assume that's a compliment. I haven't heard that one before.
Definitely,
thank you.
Definitely.
I'm fine. I'm great, in fact. I'll get better. What's up?
I wanted to comment on your first guest this morning.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if he's even read Atlas Shrugged.
Not only has he read it, I believe he wrote a book about it.
Oh, wow. Because some of the things that he was commenting on, saying that the corporations should be more involved with the government legislation, seemed a little backwards from the whole Ayn Rand thing, because in the book, the corporations are writing the legislation to drive their competitors out of business.
Mm-hmm. But they're doing that in Atlas Shrugged. They're doing that because the government has become so corrupt it's allowing them to. I mean, the whole point of Atlas Shrugged is government bad, corporations good, ultimately. Or, you know, John Galt, those entrepreneurs who stand up against the grain, good. Government bad, and a few corporations who get in bed with them are bad.
Yeah, but it just seems to me that the theme of the, like, the whole first 10 chapters or so of the book was that corporations writing legislation to drive their competitors out of business is a bad thing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's been more than 25 years since I read the book, so I can't specifically address that. But Alexander Goldmark, our board op in Washington, in New York, rather, who has more recently read the book, says you're absolutely right, Rachel. So thanks for updating us on it. I appreciate it. It's great to hear from you.
Thanks
for calling, Daniel in Robertsville, Alabama. Hey, Daniel, welcome to the program.
How you doing, Tom?
Good.
I just got a comment about your guest. For me, from the standpoint that I heard, it sounded like more of corporate fascism, maybe like what Mussolini tried to do in the 20s.
Well, yeah, when Mussolini merged corporations into government, in fact, he dissolved Parliament and replaced it with the Cameo de Fascistio Corporaciones, the Chamber of the Fascist Corporations.
Yep. So we learned from their mistakes? I don't think so.
Well,
this government's going so far south, it's scary.
Yeah, or so far Reich. You know,
I used to be a Republican, or what I like to call now is the American Workers' Party.
There you go.
I've gone liberal or Democrat since then.
Well, you know what's amazing, Daniel, is, you know, I will openly and gladly and proudly refer to myself as a liberal or as a progressive, but the reality is that oddly, by saying that, you find, you know, mainstream media commentators saying that I'm a lefty, right? I mean, you know, CNN now, they just hired J.C. Watts, the Republican from Oklahoma. They just hired Glenn Beck. I mean, it's like they're trying to reinvent CNN as Fox News or something, I think. And
yeah.
And they would characterize me and my positions as being left. But the real left in America is the old Communist Party. I mean, that's the left. And the Communist Party is impotent. They have no power. They have no say. They've got nothing. You know, communism has been discredited by and large in a large society. I mean, it may work in a kibbutz, but it doesn't work in large society. And that's why I say, and I know there's a couple of people in the chat room who really take this out of context, tragically, I think. I say the left in America is dead. We are the radical middle. We really are mainstream America. You and I, and I'm not sure that we necessarily have to have these labels, although you know, it's good shorthand to say, yes, I'm a progressive. That means I'm in favor of, you know, clean environment and holding corporations accountable and a strong labor movement and a viable social safety net and, you know, good public education and so on. But that's mainstream America. You ask most Americans if they want Medicare to cover everybody, they'll say yes. You ask most Americans if they want clear skies versus a little more profit for Exxon, they'll say, I'll take the clear skies. And, you know, it's anyhow, you got me off on a rant, Daniel.
Well, at the least, I thought that this government would at least uphold the Constitution.
Yeah.
Apparently, I was very wrong.
Yeah, you were very wrong. Yeah, and I at the very least thought so too. And now nothing ceases to amaze me. Nothing ceases to amaze me. Daniel, thank you very much. Karen in Federal Way, Washington. Speaking of nothing ceasing to amaze us, you have some thoughts on our hearing from Osama bin Laden today?
Yes, I was really astonished. He's back again, and frankly, I tend to agree with you. That I think the guy is dead, but he somehow comes back over and over again. And at such time, you know, right before the 2004 election, and right now, the Republicans are having problems.
Right. And isn't it odd that bin Laden is saying the same thing the Democrats are saying just before an election? And a couple of years ago, Bush is saying...
So I don't know where he is. Nor, you know, I just don't spend that much time on it, to be honest with you.
And you know, he's saying, well, I don't know. Why? Because I think he's dead. And I think that the tape that showed up in the 2004 elections of bin Laden saying that basically, you know, it was spun by the media and I think intentionally so.
Mm-hmm.
You vote for Democrats and you're going to have bin Laden in your backyard. I think it was a phony. And I think that this is a phony because I think the guy is dead.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks.
And by the way, Karen, let me add, if he's not dead, and if this really is Osama bin Laden, it would make perfect sense that he would create a tape that would be politically supportive of the Republicans, because the Republicans are doing exactly what Osama bin Laden wants. He wanted to be made a hero of the Islamic world. They made him a hero of the Islamic world when he was in danger. I mean, the day after 9/11, when people were marching in Tehran with lighted candles in support of the United States, in Tehran, Iran, he was in danger of losing the entire Islamic world. And if George Bush had stood up and said, this man is a criminal and a psychopath, and we need to pull the police forces of the world together and capture him and put him in prison and recognize the sociopathy, the psychopathology of this, the mental illness of this, and the criminality of this, then that would have been the end of Osama bin Laden. It would have been the end of Al-Qaeda. Instead, George Bush thought this was his Pearl Harbor moment and decided, you know, like Superman has to have Lex Luthor. You know, you've got to have the goodness of a character in a play is always, or movie or book or whatever, is always defined only by the evilness of their antagonist. You can't, you know, and so he's like, here's my Lex Luthor. I'm going to make this guy bigger than life. And he did. George Bush has done everything Osama bin Laden wanted. Absolutely everything. So if it really is bin Laden, and as I said, I don't think it is, then it makes perfect sense that he would be out there saying things that are supportive of the Bush administration. Karen, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Great to hear from you. Rich in Columbus, Ohio. Hey, Rich, welcome to the program.
Hey, hi, Tom. Hey, I believe 100% in public financing of the elections.
Yes, sir.
Because when I go to elect somebody, when I go to vote for somebody, I look at their platform. That's what I vote for a person on. Now, when a lobbyist walks in there with a fistful of money, that negates 90% of the votes that people put him in office.
Sure.
You know, it's just not right.
Yeah, I mean, case in point, the bankruptcy law. Here, this is incredible. I mean, you've got rich people like Donald Trump. They carved out an exception where they can have asset protection trusts, where if you're wealthy, you can put your money in an asset protection trust, declare bankruptcy, and hang on to your assets. But if you're the middle-class guy, if you're making anything less than basically about $300,000 a year all the way down to, you know, $5,000 a year, if you don't have enough money to create an asset protection trust, takes about $250,000, then you're screwed. And this gets through Congress. And who benefits from this? Nobody except the banks.
Yeah, and if you take the money away from the lobbyists, I actually live in Pennsylvania. My senator, Santorum.
Oh, my.
If they walk into Santorum's office without any money, they'll get the same thing I got. They'll get that door slammed in their face.
Yeah. Did you try and walk into Santorum's office?
Yeah. They wouldn't let me in.
Yeah.
Well, mm-hmm. I went in to see him. He was there that day. I said I'd like to talk to him, and they said, "Well, he's busy. He doesn't have time."
Right.
Matter of fact, after I was sitting there, he walked right past me, going out to his car, and left.
Yeah.
Good
old Ricky, the man of the people.
Oh, yeah, he is.
Well, you have my sympathies, Rich. Thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. Jerry in Olympia, Washington. Hey, Jerry.
Hey, Tom. I'm another 100% supporter of the proposition of publicly funded elections. How about we make a vote worth $1,000 and say $25 of it is to cover the cost of elections, and then the remainder you get as a tax deduction, as an incentive for voting.
Hmm.
And
you know, they do in Australia, you have to pay a $25 fee in your taxes if you fail to vote.
Yeah,
I don't think that forcing people to vote are like that. And here's the interesting thing, Jerry. The reason why the last election cycle cost $1 billion is because about $750 million of that went to basically TV and radio stations and the big networks.
Sure.
If they were required, as they were under before Reagan suspended the Fairness Doctrine, if they were required, as they were before 1987, to offer free airtime to political candidates, then that $25 per person cost could go down to $3 per person.
Well, yeah, and we really do own the airwaves.
Well, we used to.
Before the telecommunications people carved it up.
Yeah, between Ronald Reagan and Bill Clinton, and it was largely Bill Clinton in 1996, the Telecommunications Act, selling them off, and it was a crime against all of us, in my opinion. But, Jerry, you raise a good point, and I appreciate it. Thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for listening to us there. Oh, my goodness. Well, I think it's possible. I think the time has come. It is working now in several states. Arizona's doing it. Maine is doing it. Some communities are doing it. The city of Portland here is doing it. Publicly funded elections. Let's just get all the corporate money out of the elections and make it work right. It's 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Whistle, whistle, now seems we've lost our character way to pursuing liberty. liberty and justice for all. So what like can I have to say for any patriotic all-American woman, child, man? No flag should ever be more important than the rights for which it stands.
There you go. No flag should ever be more important than the rights for which it stands. Tell that to Hillary Clinton with her flag-burning amendment. 50 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 3 days after the critically acclaimed film Brokeback Mountain won Golden Globe Awards in four major categories, according to Andy Borowitz, BorowitzReport.com, Senator Rick Santorum called for a constitutional amendment banning gay westerns. Mr. Santorum on the Senate floor today said, "We cannot sit idly by and watch Brokeback Mountain sashay into the mainstream of American culture. If allowed to flourish, gay westerns will destroy the sanctity of traditional westerns." He added that if the film continued to gain acceptance in the heartland, several western states might soon legalize marriage between gay cowboys. Pennsylvania senator explained that his proposal of a constitutional amendment banning gay westerns was not a rash decision on his part. Said Santorum, "I only reached this decision after watching Brokeback Mountain 10, maybe 12 times. Mr. Santorum added that it was unconscionable that the producers of the film had cast an actor as hot and sexy as Heath Ledger as one of the gay cowboys since, to quote Santorum, he only makes the gay cowboy lifestyle seem more enticing." End of quote. In a sign that Mr. Santorum might have more constitutional amendments to propose, he said that he is also very concerned that Hollywood might someday produce a remake of the film Benji featuring man-on-dog sex. Mr. Santorum said, "I'm going to be extra vigilant on this issue. If there is a remake of Benji featuring man-on-dog sex, I will be waiting in line for a ticket on the very first day." Mm-hmm. That from Andy Borowitz, of course, tongue-in-cheek, BorowitzReport.com. John in Los Angeles, California on the line. Hey, John, thanks for calling the program. What's up?
I was just calling because I was wondering if you had heard about the report on Defense Watch about the dragon skin body armor.
Yeah, I ranted about it for about 15, 20 minutes. I think it was yesterday or maybe the day before.
I apologize, and I haven't heard your show.
Yeah, no, it's, yes, the problem that you're referring to, John, for our listeners who didn't hear it, and just because, you know, something gets said doesn't mean everybody hears it, is that, first of all, a couple of years ago, out of embarrassment, by and large, the Congress voted to give every soldier $1,000 to buy body armor, and now those soldiers who have bought dragon skin body armor, which is apparently a very high quality, high-end brand of body armor, are being told that if they are killed wearing that body armor, they will not be eligible for the $400,000 life insurance policy. In fact, some of them are simply being told you can't wear this stuff.
Right.
And
yeah, I know. It's appalling to me.
Well, it's just another example of the Bush administration supporting our troops.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, who is it that has the contract for the body armor that was issued that, you know, it's by that company Point Blank, which is owned by that guy who just threw the $10 million bar mitzvah party for his daughter.
Yeah.
You know, and he made over $70 million last year.
Yeah, surprise, surprise.
Yeah.
War is, you know, as General Smedley Butler said, war is a racket. And, yeah. John, thanks for the call and for raising the issue.
Okay.
I appreciate it.
Thank
Good
you.
To hear from you. Frank in Kansas City, Missouri. Hey, Frank.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What's up?
Well, you know, we've been listening to these crazy antics going on lately, and I was just wondering why isn't anybody talking about term limits seriously for senators now?
I think, frankly, because most, you know, it sounds good in general, but the Senate and in the House, for that matter, people acquire power by virtue of seniority. And if we're talking about your senator, I have no problem with your senator in Missouri having term limits, but I'd like my senator here to have the right to work his way up to be the head of some committee.
Well,
I mean, that's how the average American views it.
I just wonder, they seem to get together and, you know, go from being 40 to about 5 years old.
Yeah, no, I think, Frank, that the term limits argument, and it's an argument that's been in for a long time, Thomas Jefferson argued in favor of term limits. He said that nobody should serve more than one elected term in office.
Right.
This goes back a long way. But I think that what it's doing is addressing the symptom rather than the cause. The problem isn't that people are in Washington, D.C. too long. As a matter of fact, we've had some people in public service for many years who are, you know, great people. I mean, you know, really, truly great people. and doing marvelous public service, and I'm glad that they're there, and I'd like them to stay there because they're doing such a great job. The problem is that we have a system that has been corrupted by corporate money and the money of inherited wealth. And therefore, it has been turned to be the servant of corporate money and inherited wealth. And that will not be solved by term limits. You'll just get people who will get corrupted faster. That's all.
So, if you don't mind me asking, then, do you have a suggestion then that you think would work better?
Yes, publicly financed elections.
You're right.
Every single one of us kicks in $10 every year as part of our income taxes, and politicians are not allowed to take any money from anybody, period. And all the TV and radio networks are required to run debates, and local TV and radio are required to let the local politicians debate. And there's a lot of public discourse, and the public is well informed, and there are no special interest groups involved at all. And it's a simple solution. It is working in several states right now. You have in Arizona, generic housewives running for political office and becoming state senators and legislators. And I don't mean that term in a derogatory way. This is how this woman describes herself. I'm forgetting her name, who was just elected, probably the most famous one. In Maine, it's working. Here in the city of Portland, it's working. It's working in communities all across the country. That's my solution. And I think its time has come. And I know that you're not going to hear the Democratic Leadership Council, the DLC, and you're not going to hear the Republican Party talking about this, but you will be hearing progressive Democrats talking about this. You will hear the Green Party talking about it. Frank, I appreciate the call. I got to move along. And you're going to be hearing people like me talking about it because it's time is here. I mean, you got the McCain-Feingold Act was so convoluted because of how corrupted the system is and because of this whole idea of corporate personhood that they had to regulate politicians rather than corporations. And it's crazy. In 1907, Teddy Roosevelt got passed a federal law that says it's a felony for a corporation to give money to politicians. Let's just take it to the next step and say, we'll pay for the elections and for the campaigns. We want to own the vote. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to our program, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. The place where reason is our lifestyle choice. 6 minutes past the hour. Our quote for the day from John F. Kennedy: the men who create power make an indispensable contribution to the nation's greatness, but the men who question power make a contribution that is just as indispensable, especially when that questioning is disinterested, for they determine whether we use power or power uses us. Michael R. LeGault is the author of a new book called Think, Why Crucial Decisions Can't Be Made in the Blink of an Eye. Michael, welcome to the program.
Nice to be here.
Hey, Michael. I take it that your book is sort of a rebut of Blink?
That's correct. Yes.
Give us the snapshot version here.
Sure. Well, you know, Blink, a book by Malcolm Gladwell, bestseller, celebrates the so-called power of thinking without thinking, which Gladwell defines as the best way to make decisions is through a very rapid process involving intuition and instinct.
And experience.
I'm sorry?
And experience.
Well,
in other words, one of the points that Gladwell makes is that if I go to visit a physician, that physician has seen thousands of patients in their lives. They've seen a lot of different symptoms that played out in a lot of different ways, and I imply something or suggest something, complain of something. That physician is more likely to have what they perceive to be an intuition, but is actually a knowing at some deep level based on years or decades of actual experience, even though it presents itself to them in their mind as an intuition about what's going on with me, that if I came to you, Michael LeGault, you wouldn't have because you haven't seen thousands of patients.
Yes, and I think the problem I have is way is the way it's presented within the book, which doesn't really upplay that experience factor that is involved in those type of intuitive decisions. It sort of downplays it and concentrates on those 2 seconds in which you, as he calls it, make that blink-like decision and have this eureka moment.
But isn't that what we do in conversation? I mean, do you carefully think out what you're going to say when you answer me?
No, of course not. But you base what you say on what the other person says, and so there's a certain linearity to there should be a certain linearity to the thought process that we are using in conversation.
But you're also basing it on experience, and you're also basing it on your worldview. I mean, one of the criticisms of your book, Think, we're talking with Michael LaGault, he's the author of Think, kind of a rebuttal of Blink, Why Crucial Decisions Can't Be Made in the Blink of an Eye. You take on liberals and you take on Rachel Carlson. You say that, for example, her book, Silent Spring, caused Americans to get all hysterical. You say because she said that DDT would cause cancer. She did mention that in her book, but the title of her book, Silent Spring, referred to DDT's And we now know that DDT probably doesn't cause cancer, although it may have endocrine mimicking effects that would produce other symptoms. But the main point was that DDT causes the thinning of eggshells in birds and would lead to the death of birds, which did, and thus we would have a silent spring. There would be no bird calls. I don't understand why you were picking on Rachel Carlson, or was it just because she's one of them liberals?
I wasn't picking up. I actually mentioned in the that section that you're talking about that she was absolutely right about the effect that DDT has on the thinning of eggshells in birds. Where she went overboard, and I think this has had an effect, and it still has an effect on our the type of environmental regulations we have, is that in claiming that DDT was a carcinogen, it, in my view, set off the spark that set off this whole view of sort of nature as this pure thing where in which there are no carcinogens, only man is polluting, and in that everything that every industrial activity of man is harmful to humans. And I think it's an emotional reaction. It's not a scientific reaction, and because of that, I think we've become a society with very little tolerance for risk.
Well, I just have to say, I remember 1962. I don't know if you do or not. I was alive, conscious, and in school at the time, and the concern that I recall around Silent Spring and throughout the 60s is that became sort of an iconic book that led to many various environmental movements. Wasn't so much, gee, we're all going to die from cancer. There were a lot of other things that seemed to be producing that as well. And there has been, an explosion in cancers over the years and that has been largely unaccounted for. But was the idea that we might be doing so much damage to the ecosphere, that we might be committing biological suicide on a planet-wide scale, or at least on a region-wide scale? I mean, it's on a national scale.
Well, the environmental question is one that's close to me, and I consider myself an environmentalist, but I also consider myself a rationalist, and I think that the main point of my book is that we've lost contact with the rational side of our thought process, and we make a lot of our decisions based on emotion and intuition. One of the studies I cite related to environmental issues, a group of EPA officials polled people and asked them their top, actually it was an independent group, they polled a group of people, just citizens, and asked them their top concerns, environmental concerns. Then they polled officials at the EPA and asked them what their top environmental concerns were. Well, the two were totally different, which, tells me that a lot of in the professional environmental area, their concerns are related to science and risk. A lot of the concerns of the public is related to perception.
Hmm. Some of your points, culture of image and instant gratification, reality shows, computer games, rendered curiosity, the mind and spirit all but obsolete, makes sense to me. I'm wondering why you chose to make this a political tome. I mean, you know, why go after Noam Chomsky?
Well, the basic point of the book is apolitical. It's that we can enter this realm of rationality and reason to solve problems and to get beyond political partisanship. But the consequences of that argument, there are consequences that percolate into the culture, into society.
Well, in reading your book, I really get it that you think that liberals and progressives are irrational and that conservatives and objectivists and libertarians are rational.
I think that there are irrational people on both sides of the political fence. However, I believe that the consequences of irrationality or emotional-based thought have more, I guess you would say, tenor or resonance within the liberal community.
Give me one example.
I'll give you one example. I think that for instance, the whole environmental issue with global warming, not proven. It's a theory, but that seems to be.
You haven't noticed that the ice is vanishing in the Arctic?
The ice isn't vanishing in the Arctic. The ice is vanishing from the glaciers. Some glaciers has been melting since the last part of the later part of the 19th century, as part of the coming out of the Little Ice Age, and a lot of scientists think this could be just natural variation in the sun's output.
And the vast majority of scientists believe that there is an element of that, and that human involvement, specifically carbon dioxide and other things in the atmosphere, methane and other greenhouse gases, are affecting this. I mean, you're preaching rationality, yet when the IPCC gets together and 2,600 of the world's top scientists issue a unanimous consensus statement, you think that's irrational?
That's not a unanimous consensus statement by any means. There's a lot of disagreement about the...
Well, you got Fred Smith. I mean, you got a half a dozen crackpots out there who are funded by ExxonMobil, but
No, I don't agree with that. I don't agree with that. That is a consensus statement. And you're talking about the summary statement of the IPCC that was put together by a select group of people. That's frequently cited in the news media as an authoritative statement. In fact, there
isn't it. Let's just go back to the bigger picture, Michael, because we have less than a minute left. Isn't it more rational to err on the side of caution than not?
I don't believe. In this case, I don't believe it's a theory that explains all the facts. And
okay.
I believe that money can be put to better use.
All right. Michael LaGaulle, the author of Think, Why Critical Decisions Can't Be Made in the Blink of an Eye. Michael, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Shake it up. Shake it up. Shake it up.
Indeed.
Shake
welcome back,
up.
My friends. Viagra for your brain. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 21 minutes past the hour. Greg Gorman with us from the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., talkradionews.com. Hey, Greg, what's up?
Well, we heard from Senator Leahy this morning at Georgetown University here in Washington, D.C. He made his announcement. Not unexpected that he will be voting against Judge Alito. Alito.
Yeah, good. Good on him.
Still, we've heard from Senator Nelson of Nebraska. He's the only one voting for. He's the only Democrat who's voting for. In his statement, Senator Leahy said that he was, you know, disappointed and that in this time of checks and balances with the White House, he doesn't believe that Alito will be a voice for a check or a balance.
Now, John Conyers has announced that he's going to be holding hearings on the domestic spying program. He doesn't have the authority of Congress to do that because the Republicans will not give it to him. So he's just simply going to do it himself, like he did when he investigated the theft of the election in Ohio and ended up publishing the result of the testimony as a book, What Went Wrong in Ohio, which If anybody listening has not read yet, run out and buy it tomorrow morning or this afternoon, What Went Wrong in Ohio by John Conyers. Any buzz at all about this in Washington, D.C.?
Not yet, but I've actually been in a hearing in the House with John Conyers before, and he is a powerful man when he gets on up in front of that group of people. He knows how to run a hearing, and I would like to see the I'd like to see the Republicans try to stop him from this. He's going to do what he has to do. He loves it. You know, he's a good
the institution.
Voice, and there will be buzz over the next few days, I'm sure.
Yeah, he's in many ways he's the institutional memory of the House of Representatives.
Exactly.
I mean, he was there through the Nixon years. He's been there forever. I mean, he's been there for a long, long time, and you know, really knows what he's doing and what he's speaking of.
He does well, and of course, you know, if we're speaking about the wiretapping issue, you know, there's this organization called the Congressional Research Service
that's
come out against the president and saying that what he did was illegal. And the White House is now trying to spin that away from them, saying, look, you know what, they didn't understand, they didn't have the right information.
Well, this is the second time the Congressional Research
Exactly.
Service, which is a nonpartisan arm of Congress, of the legislative branch, an investigative nonpartisan arm of the legislative branch, the second time they have come out and said George W. Bush broke the law.
Right, and that's because he did not have constant oversight with members of Congress, and the White House is saying that he did, even though they're still saying that this group, you know, CRS, you know, got it wrong. Obviously, they don't because, you know, they're nonpartisan and they're spouting facts the way they are, and the president, according to them, broke the law. Now, you know, hearings, when they start, whether John Conyers or not, whoever they start, all this information, you know, is going to come out. And, of course, you know, we know the ACLU is actually suing the government to stop this, you know, all the wiretapping process.
Right. Although the government is saying they don't have standing for the lawsuit, where do you think that's going to go?
That's going to go where it always goes. It's always going to be a showdown between the government and the ACLU. And, you know, someone will let a court decide.
Yeah.
And if it gets to the Supreme Court, but, you know, if it takes a year or however long, we'll have Justice Alito, and it'll be one of those very interesting cases. It could be a 5-4 split, obviously.
Now, Greg Gorman, I'm still strongly recommending that people call toll-free to Congress, 888-355-3588. 888-355-3588, and ask for their for both of their senators, one after the other. And if they speak to a Republican, to say, please break ranks with your party. This man, Alito, is neither conservative nor Republican. He's a right-wing crank or a right-wing extremist and should not be sitting on the Supreme Court. And if they're speaking with a Democrat, ask them not only to vote against him, but to support a filibuster of him.
Well, and that, you know, that's great advice. As a matter of fact, I heard today that Judge Alito is actually meeting with some senators, and they're still trying to make up their mind. Even though the process is over, you know, he still has to talk to them. He's trying to make up some people's minds. If constituents call into their senators, they still have a chance to speak to them.
Right, yeah, and now is the time. This battle is not over yet, and it's time to carry it on. Greg, thanks a lot for the report from Washington, D.C.
Always a pleasure.
Good talking with you. It's 25 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman radio program. Larry in Seattle, Washington on the line. Hey, Larry, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. You don't have to pull your hair out over the climate change issue. There's a great article in the October 25th, 2005 issue of Science Times in the New York Times, Melting Sea Ice. Most scientists agree that an ice-free Arctic Ocean could become a reality this century. Our Navy has pictures that have proved that the sea ice up there has been reduced by 70% over the past 30 years. The Canadian and Russian navies are both preparing for Northwest Passage.
Oh, I know. And in fact, they're lobbying politically for who's gonna own that real estate. And not only that, we're seeing in some of these glaciers that the melts are down to levels that, you know, they're exposing ice that can be radiocarbon dated at 10, 30, 50, and 70,000 years old. So it's been a long time since this melt happened. This is not just a little ice age.
Absolutely.
Anyhow, we've got just a few seconds
left. It's about embryonic stem cell research. As we know, the discredited Korean scientist Woo-Suk Hwang was discharged from his position at the Seoul National University because he has faked all of his research. The bad news is I received an email alert yesterday from the newscientist.com that he had filed an application for a patent back on 30 December 2003, and it appears that the patent will be granted, and this will stake a claim in over 120 countries for a legal monopoly on the broad concept of embryonic stem cell lines derived from cloned human embryos.
Holy cow. Larry, I don't think he's going to be able to hold it. You know, I just don't think he's going to be able to hold it. We'll see how it plays out. Thanks for letting us know. 27 minutes.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to your light at the end of the tunnel of talk radio. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. A fledgling alumni group headed by a former campus Republican leader is offering students payments up to $100 per class, writes the Los Angeles Times, to provide information on instructors, you know, basically who are liberals. The Bruin Alumni Association, brand new, started by a 24-year-old kid by the name of Andrew Jones. He's got $22,000 from 100 donors. He's already got one student who says, yeah, give me $100 per class, and I'll make a surreptitious tape and detailed lecture notes and give them to you. These guys, they've named education professor Peter McLaren at UC Berkeley number one on their Dirty 30, ranking the worst of the worst. They say this Canadian native teaches the next generation of teachers and professors how to properly indoctrinate students. Professor McLaren, in a telephone interview, called the alumni group's tactics beneath contempt. He said any sober, concerned citizen would look at this and see right through it as a reactionary form of McCarthyism. Any decent American is going to see through this kind of right-wing propaganda. I just find it has no credibility. Amen. And yet, I'll bet these guys are going to get a pile of money, a pile of publicity, and this is not the beginning. This is not the end by any means. This is just the beginning of this kind of thing. The new McCarthyism sweeping the United States. And I'm telling you, it's infiltrating all dimensions of the media. When CNN is hiring, you know, J.C. Watts and Glenn Beck, notorious right-wingers, extremists. We're losing it. In the meantime, the feds, the Justice Department, they just can't deal with the possibility that there might be pornography on the internet. What they say they're trying to do is protect children from exposure to pornography on the internet. We have laws against that. And, you know, they can Google around and find it themselves. But no, that's not good enough for them. We're not, by the way, talking here about illegal pornography. We're not talking about snuff films or kiddie porn or any of that kind of stuff. We're talking about just your plain old garden variety, you know, dirty movies, porn sites, you know, your basic porn sites that literally millions of Americans visit and spend billions of dollars with every year. This is a major industry. As Howard Mintz writes in the Mercury News, the Bush administration on Wednesday asked a federal judge to order Google to turn over a broad range of material from its closely guarded databases. The move is part of a government effort to revive an Internet child protection law struck down 2 years ago by the U.S. Supreme Court. Justice Department lawyers revealed that Google has refused to comply with the subpoena issued last year for the records, which included requests for 1 million random web addresses and records of all Google searches for any 1 year period. Yes, my friends, Big Brother is watching. Or at least they want to. Here we have the Bush administration saying to a private corporation, in this case Google, you be the spies for us, please. And Google saying, no, I think not. More specifically, Nicole Wong, Associate General Counsel for Google, said the company will fight the government's efforts vigorously. She said, Google is not a party to this lawsuit, and the demand for this information is overreaching. As Ray Everett Church, a South Bay privacy consultant, so this is in California, said, this is exactly the kind of case that privacy advocates have long feared. The idea that these massive databases are being thrown open to anyone with a court document is a worst-case scenario. If they lose this fight, consumers will think twice about letting Google deep into their lives. He goes on to say, the government can't even claim that this is for national security. They're just using it to get to the search engines to do their research for them in a way that compromises the civil liberties of other people. This all goes, in a way you could say, this all goes back to John Ashcroft paying $7,000 for a blue blanket to hang over the naked breast of the Greek statue of the Lady Justice, or whatever her title is, who holds the scales there at the Justice Department. I'd say it actually goes back to Queen Victoria and her neuroses. There seems to be something peculiarly, however you say that word, American and British. I just, you know, living on the continent in Europe for a year and living in Germany, I didn't experience this. But I am guessing that this is going to become another election year issue. You see, when these guys start ramping this stuff up, the government indicated, by the way, that other unspecified search engines have agreed to release the information, but not Google. And here are the Google has 46%, excuse me, the U.S. web search market. Yahoo is second with 23%. Microsoft Network, MSN, third with 11%. The government says unspecified search engines have agreed to release the information, but not Google. Google is fighting it. Good on you, Google. Go for it. Mining for kids. The Pentagon has created now a database. You know, the No Child Left Behind law, it said that if a school is taking federal funds, then they have to give the Pentagon information about their kids so that the Pentagon can try and recruit them. But it said that you can opt out. So you can say to your school, don't give the Pentagon my kids' information. Well, to get around that, the Pentagon has gone to private corporations. They've outsourced this thing and created a separate database. They went to 70 million dollars they gave to Mullen Advertising in 2002. This is a Massachusetts firm whose clients include General Motors, Hooked on Phonics, XM Satellite Radio, and 3Com. This is according to an article by my old friend Kate Cassa in the Vermont Guardian. The Boston Journal reported in October that the Pentagon had spent a total of $206 million on the Jammers program to date. Could spend another $137 million over the next 2 years. What is this program? It is a private database. Joint Advertising Market Research and Studies, a storehouse of questionable legality that includes the names and personal details of more than 30 million U.S. children and young people between the ages of 16 and 23. Kate notes in her article for the Vermont Guardian, you can find it over at Common Dreams also, a lot of people told their schools, don't give my kid's name to the Army or to the military, and they're being recruited anyway. How did they find out? Well, they got around it. Last fall, 100 privacy and civil rights groups sent a letter to Don Rumsfeld urging him to dismantle the database. Pat Leahy of Vermont, he says, I think this is absolutely wrong. But this administration, and in fact, Clinton and Feingold both sent Rumsfeld a letter back on June 24th asking to immediately cease creation of this database. He's spit in their faces, metaphorically speaking. In fact, if you want to contact the Department of Defense and find out if your kid is in the database, this won't remove him, by the way. You have to send them a letter, including your child's name, date of birth, current address, and telephone number. Why would they want that? Well, maybe so that they can put him in the database if he's not there. Meanwhile, Pat Leahy, the number two guy, the number one Democrat on the House Judiciary Committee, in my opinion, one of the wisest guys in the United States State Senate, I mean that in a positive sense, wisest men in the United States Senate with regard to issues of the law, former federal prosecutor and attorney, been on the Judiciary Committee forever. In remarks today, he said, and I quote, central during the hearings on this nomination, that's Alito, was the issue of whether Judge Alito would serve as an effective constitutional check on the presidency or whether he would instead adhere to unchecked expansion of presidential power in accordance with the extreme and, I might add, immodest theory of unitary executive. Presidential power was the first subject I explored with Chief Justice Roberts in his confirmation hearing, and it was the first subject I explored with Judge Alito in his hearings. This is a fundamental question for me, writes Patrick Leahy, or said Patrick Leahy this morning, as I consider this nomination. It is also a fundamental question for the Senate and for this country at a time when we have a president prone to unilateralism and arrogant assertions of executive power that range all the way up to illegal spying on Americans. Can this president or any president order illegal spying on Americans? Asked Pat Leahy. Can this president or any president authorize torture in defiance of our criminal statutes and our international agreements? Can this president or any president defy our laws and constitution to hold American citizens in custody indefinitely without a court review? Well, says Pat Leahy, after reviewing thousands of pages of rulings and writings and days of testimony from Judge Alito, I have concluded that this nominee has failed to address these central concerns on the issue of government power. Preventing government intrusion into the personal privacy and freedoms of Americans is one of the hallmarks of the Supreme Court. Yet there is no reason, says Patrick Leahy, number two guy in the Senate Judiciary Committee, lead Democrat on this issue. Every other Democrat should be listening to him. He says, yet there is no reason to believe that Judge Alito will serve as an effective check and balance on government intrusion into the lives of Americans. Indeed, his record suggests otherwise. Pat Leahy just comes right out and says it. He says at the hearings, Judge Alito failed this test literally. He twice misstated the generally recognized framework for the court's reviewing claims of government power in answer to my first questions. I corrected him when he could not distinguish between what Justice Jackson called the zone of twilight and the situation when Congress had not acted in an area where the president claimed authority and the circumstances where Congress has acted and the president's authority is seen as its lowest ebb and subject to more demanding justification. An example of this latter category is the current wiretapping of Americans in light of Congress's enactment of FISA. He said the Senate considers this nomination at a pivotal point in our nation's history, and it is. Call your senator now, 1-888-355-3588. Your senators, each one of us has two, unless you live in Washington, D.C. Then you can call anybody, 1-888-355-3588. Let them know. Filibuster Alito, 45 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. News without conflicts and global corporate interests. It's the Tom Hartman radio program where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, don't think so, no way. No siree, Bob. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. But first, we caught you doing something right. Congratulations to the state of Maine. Maine began requiring makers of computer monitors and TVs to pay most of the cost of recycling and disposing of their products once they are discarded. Maine communities have been charging individuals $15 to $20 to dispose of their electronic gear. Now it's going to cost $2. The discarded items will be sorted and sent to recyclers, where toxic materials such as lead and mercury will be removed. Manufacturers will then be billed for the cost, said David Lytle, Acting Commissioner of Environmental Protection. If manufacturers had to consider all the costs of the products they're making, including the cost of disposal, we would have a very different economy. And I think, frankly, a much healthier one. Jeff in South Hero, Vermont, listening on WVAA. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you doing today?
I am great, but I'll get better. What's on your mind, Jeff?
I want to get your take on something. First, I'm going to tell you a little story about this academic spying that you're talking about.
Yeah.
When I was in school in the early 80s, I went to UMass Boston. And under the Reagan administration, they did the same thing. They sent out things trying to get students to turn in left-wing professors.
They must have had great fun in Noam Chomsky's class.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And I used to work for the newspaper, and we started a little campaign. Like, we actually published the 800 number and this and this, but our little campaign was, have people call in and turn in right-wing professors and say they were sprouting liberal views in class just to confuse the system.
Why not say they're spouting, fascist views or Nazi views?
Well, because I just wanted to confuse the system.
Because the Reagan administration would have said, oh, okay, no problem.
Oh, they would have loved it, of course.
That's our guy.
But anyways, I'm calling today, I want to get your take on Bill O'Reilly's call for a boycott on the state of Vermont. Have you heard about this?
Bill O'Reilly.
Well, the shut up line has happened only once in 6 years.
You want to know what I'm doing?
Shut up.
Well, you just shut up about
sex.
What?
Listen,
cut his mic.
No,
hey,
that's
shut up.
No,
you had your 35 minutes. Shut up.
But it is our duty as loyal Americans to shut up and shut up publicly. We expect every American to support our military, and if they can't do that, to shut up.
There you go. Well, that's enough of that. Anyhow, so I take it Bill O'Reilly's telling Vermont to shut up?
Well, I mean, I don't know like how much you know about local stuff anymore, but we had a case here about a judge giving a treatment sentence to a sexual offender rather than send them to jail.
Right.
And so boycott, like, he's been calling for a boycott on all of Vermont. I've got the quote here if you want to hear it.
Yeah, no, I don't need it.
Okay.
I mean, just
it's
the story.
Interesting. It's pretty interesting.
Yeah, I mean, you know, O'Reilly, I mean, what can I, here's another O'Reillyism.
So, all those clowns over at the liberal radio network, we could incarcerate them immediately. Will you have that done, please? Send over the FBI and just put them in chains? Because they, you know, they're undermining everything.
I mean, the guy's in love with power. You know, he's in love with the idea of power. He's a power freak. What can I say?
Yeah, I agree.
So what's Jeff? You know, my take on it would be ignore it.
Oh no, actually, like it just makes me laugh.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, first he starts boycotting France and other things, and now
right. Yeah.
Your screener asked me like, well, how do you boycott Vermont?
Right.
I said, well, I guess you boycott France like you join AA and don't drink wine. I mean,
right? Yeah. I mean, you know, my favorite story from you know when I lived in the 10 years that I lived in Vermont was during the height of the civil unions thing, and all these people had you know take back Vermont, which meant stop civil unions.
Right.
But it said take back Vermont plastered on their barns and in their front yards and everything, you know, and old Ruth, you know, out there running on that as her campaign platform against Howard Dean and Ruth Dwyer. And all these tourists coming into town going, oh, boy, I guess these Vermonters are really into our buying some maple syrup and taking it home.
Well, I'll tell you one last story on that one. Do you remember the counter bumper sticker?
Yeah.
The civil union people, they said, take Vermont from behind.
Yeah, there you go. I like the take Vermont forward ones. Those were good ones, too. Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. It's
okay,
good to hear from you. I appreciate it. Michael in Antioch, California. Hey, Michael, welcome to the program.
Hello, Tom. We talked a little bit about socialism last time I called, and I think we got a little mixed up. I'm not talking about the ideological stuff that the so-called communist countries such as China and the Soviet Union and so forth. There's never been a...
You're not talking about socialism as defined by Karl Marx.
Yeah, well, there's never been a communist country. We know that. There can't be because of people. But I'm talking about, is there... I talk to people a lot. I got laid off by a Fortune 500 global corporation, and I kind of complained about it, as would be normal.
Mm-hmm.
And the answers I get is, hey, this is America. We're a capitalist country. They're out to make a profit, and you can't blame them for that. And so they go on and on and on. It's as if it's some sort of legality.
Capitalism is not enshrined in our Constitution, Michael, if that's your question.
Pardon me?
Capitalism, or any other economic system for that matter, is not enshrined in our Constitution. Our Constitution talks about how we govern ourselves. It doesn't talk about how we conduct economic, other than there's one place in the Constitution where it says that the federal government has the right to regulate commerce between the states,
which is called
the Commerce Clause.
More towards a socialist. Leaning.
Well, in a way, yeah. I mean, basically what it says is we, the people at the federal level, reserve the right to make sure that when commerce is conducted in ways that cross state lines, that commerce is done in a way that we have oversight of, that it's done in a way, ultimately, that will benefit we, the people. And I'll tell you, Michael, your experience and the experience of many Americans with these very large corporations and these large multinational corporations in particular flies in the face of the Commerce Clause. And clause and makes a mockery of the Constitution. It's a tragedy. But in answer to your direct question, no, capitalism is not enshrined in the Constitution. And we can continue that conversation on another time. But one of these days, we're just going to have to take an hour and just really dig into economics. In fact, why don't we just start the next hour with a little discussion of economics? 57 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, what's wrong with this picture? The cons are running around semi-hysterically saying, the airlines are falling, or at least their stock value is, and why? Well, it's because of those pesky unions. Is a union, they want reasonable pay, they want to have pensions, they want to have health care. We can't have that. In fact, two interesting stories. It's just extraordinary juxtaposition. Welcome back to our program, by the way. Tom Hartman here with you. Two interesting stories from today's Wall Street Journal. The first by Melanie Trotman and Susan Warren. Titled AMR, which is the parent company for American Airlines. AMR and Southwest see mixed results. They note most U.S. airlines are expected to report a loss for the fourth quarter. In fact, it starts out, American Airlines parent AMR Corp posted a wider loss for the fourth quarter. Okay. But the most heavily unionized airline in the airline industry. More of their employees are members of a union as a percentage of their employees than any other airline, and they offer some of the best union benefits and pay in the entire airline industry. That airline, which is Southwest Airlines, while everybody else is bleeding red ink, Southwest said net income rose 54% to $86 million, or 10 cents a share, from 56 million or 7 cents a share a year earlier. Southwest now, just like everybody else, took a hit in terms of fuel costs. Southwest said fuel costs rose 39%, operating expenses rose 19% to $1.82 billion, cost per seat mile rose 11% to 8.39 cents. But, said the CEO of Southwest Airlines, Gary Kelly, Southwest should be able to fly more passengers and make more money per passenger in the first quarter, that's January, February, and March, than it did a year ago. So here we have the most heavily unionized airline in the entire airline industry making the highest profits while all the other airlines are losing money. Now, one of those airlines that's losing money and, in fact, is in bankruptcy right now is United Airlines. And this is where the juxtaposition gets very interesting. An article by Susan Carey, also in today's Wall Street Journal, another part of the paper, or another page. The bankruptcy reorganization of United Airlines is about to come to an end. United is about to come out of bankruptcy. And so the 400 senior executives, the top 400 people at United Airlines, these are not the people that you meet on the airplane. These are not the pilots. These are not the flight attendants. These aren't the guys who put the baggage in the hold. These are not the ones who drive the truck that pushes the pushback. Not the guys with the little flashlight wands. No, these are the guys in the starched white shirts. The 400 top executives at United Airlines want to give themselves $150 million as the airline is emerging from bankruptcy. At the same time, three of their underfunded pension plans are being turned over to you and me to pay off, the Federal Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. At the same time, United and its flight attendants union reached a tentative agreement to provide the attendants with basically savings accounts for their old age instead of pensions. They're giving them 401ks, which is a savings account. And if you save well and you invest well, maybe you'll have enough unless you get sick or unless you get Alzheimer's, and then you're screwed. Whereas with a pension, what are called defined benefit plans, you get a certain amount no matter how long you live, no matter what. United doing away with that. And so the unions came to the bankruptcy court judge, Eugene Wetoff, and said, Judge Wetoff, at a time when United is squeezing blood out, well, these aren't their words, they're mine. At the time when United and other airlines are squeezing blood out of their employees, why are the senior executives being allowed to take $150 million and split it among 400 people? Seems like a good question. And doesn't this seem excessive to you? They asked him. And I'll just read it straight from the Wall Street Journal, Susan Carey's article in today's paper. During the first day of a hearing in Chicago to confirm UAL's reorganization plan, U.S. Bankruptcy Court Judge Eugene Wetoff listened to union complaints that the proposal is excessive at a time when other employees have made concessions to help the airline rebound financially. But, he said, the U.S. Bankruptcy Code, and I might add parenthetically here, me speaking now, not the Wall Street Journal, the newly revised U.S. Bankruptcy Code, you remember all this, it's harder for you and me to declare bankruptcy. Donald Trump, no problem, and if you're a multimillionaire, you can create an asset protection trust, put all your money in that, declare bankruptcy, get out of it, and then take your money back. But in any case, back to the Wall Street Journal. But, he said, the U.S. Bankruptcy Code does not expressly call for a review of management compensation. So the only reasonable basis for a decision if the plan, about whether or not this is excessive, these 400 guys paying themselves $150 million, whether it's excessive is, quote, what's done in the marketplace, end quote. And then they quote the judge. The judge said, it may be we have a culture in this country that overcompensates management. But United is just one enterprise that operates in that general environment. You get that? The judge in the bankruptcy court, United Airlines, the employees are going, hey, we gave up our pensions in exchange for a savings plan. We took a lower pay less of a pay increase. Actually, many of them took lower pay. Some of us got laid off. Some of us got fired. Things have been outsourced. All this kind of stuff. We're all, giving to help out here. And you got the 400 senior executives taking $150 million and sticking it in their pockets in the form of United Airlines stock, which, by the way, as the Wall Street Journal notes, many observers believe UAL stock will fare better, potentially enlarging the reward, or the award, So $150 million or more, because that's a today's stock value or an assumed stock value. They're assuming that when it comes out, it's going to start trading at $15. Company does decent at all. That's going to go much higher than that. And so the judge says, well, every other company in America is ripping off their employees. The senior executives of every other company in America are ripping off their employees, outsourcing, offshoring, and lining their pockets. We have a new class being formed, a new aristocracy being formed in the United States. Now, these are my words, not his, obviously. And so, therefore, that is the marketplace. And since United operates in that marketplace, their executives should be able to do it just like anybody else's, even though they happen to be in bankruptcy. Got the exact quote from him. Again, I'll read it. He says, it may be we have a culture in this country that overcompensates management, but United is just one enterprise that operates in that general environment, end quote. And therefore, it can't be expected to stand against the tide and be uncompetitive. Quote from the judge, the marketplace indicates this is a reasonable plan, end quote. Why is it reasonable? Because other companies are doing it. Are we yet to the point where we're looking around and saying to ourselves, there is something fundamentally wrong here? The middle class of the United States is being devastated. It is being turned into the working poor. Meanwhile, we have a small group of people, it's really probably fewer than a couple hundred thousand people, who are who are making out like absolute bandits. I mean, keep in mind, there's only 14,000 people in the United States who have an annual income of over $1 million a year. We're not talking about a lot of people. And this judge, this bankruptcy judge, says, well, everybody's doing it. It's what you got to do to survive in the airline business. And then, but the flip side, what's the most profitable airline right now? In fact, not all of them have announced their earnings, but so far the only profitable airline, as you can find on page A2 of today's Wall Street Journal, Southwest, the most heavily unionized airline in the country, takes good care of their employees. What's wrong with this picture? And why is it that on the business pages of our newspapers, we never discuss labor issues? We only discuss stock prices. Why is it that the business pages are entirely for the investor class? What has happened to labor pages, to labor discussions in American mainstream media? We've got to bring it back. 16 minutes past the hour, I'm Tom Hartman.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Junk food junkies, welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour, the place of being progressive never felt so good. Tom Hartman here with you. Dr. Sky Leininger is a noted author and editor-in-chief of The Natural Pharmacy, The A to Z Guide to Herb, Drug, Vitamin, and The A to Z Guide to Herb, Drug-Herb-Vitamin Interaction. He's also the founder, president, and CEO of a rapidly growing Portland company called Health Notes, which provides consumers with health and wellness product and lifestyle information through interactive touchscreen kiosks in grocery stores, pharmacies, and health food stores. Hey, Dr. Sky, welcome to the program.
Tom, good morning. How are you?
I am absolutely great, but I'll get better. Sky, how about you?
It's a great day.
Indeed it is. I want to talk to you. One of the questions I want to ask you is about the politics of the whole vitamin industry right now, and you know, is Congress going to be sticking their nose into it? We have 5-6 minutes here in this segment. Before we get to that, I also wanted to ask about weight loss. I have discovered that the pants that fit me before Christmas no longer do, and I suspect it has to do with holiday eating, and that for about 2 weeks when Louise had the flu and I wasn't feeling all that good myself, I stopped walking. What do you recommend for people who want to lose weight?
Well, the interesting thing about weight loss that everybody needs to remember is that as we get older, we pack on the pounds, and 2 weeks is not really getting that much older, but every decade, we add about 10 pounds of weight on average, and
so it's about a pound a year.
It's about a pound a year, but there's another part to it that's even more insidious, is that we're converting a pound a year of muscle to fat. So at the end of every 10 years, although we weigh about 10 pounds more, we're actually packing about 20 pounds more fat and 10 pounds less muscle.
And that fat produces estrogens, which put us at greater risk for cancer and other problems like that, right?
As we get more fat, there's so many health problems, and the cancers, the heart disease, the risk of stroke, the risk of Alzheimer's.
So should we all be trying to get skinnier as we get older?
I think what we need to do is, like you were saying, was we need to walk. Any amount of exercise that you add to your regimen has such an impact, and doing some walking, I'm a big believer in doing some strength training, whether it's with weights or pulleys or some kind of cabling system, because the body needs to have that exercise. And You look at guys like Jack LaLanne in their 90s now, and you really see how it pays off.
Yeah, yeah. What about diet? What about all these pills that they sell on the radio and whatnot?
Well, I think if you're combining it with watching your diet, and what I mean by that is you want to add some fiber. You want to add the green stuff and the orange stuff and the vegetables. At the same time, you want to do the exercise. Then if you're doing all of those things right and also watching your calories, so you're not getting too much of this of the overdose of the food that people tend to eat too much, Then there's a few vitamins and herbs that will really make a difference. They really become something that's part of the total package. But if what you're doing is looking to just add a pill and keep eating the way that you're eating and not do any exercise, that you're not
forget it.
That's not going to work.
Yeah. So what are the herbs that you would recommend?
Well, there's two or three that are pretty interesting. One is green tea. And green tea has this compound in it that's part of a family of things called polyphenols, and it's got a big long name, but the abbreviation is EGCG.
Mm-hmm.
And if you take that according to the instructions that you get from most of the people that are providing this, or you drink green tea, what they noticed is that over a 3-month period, people lost about 5% body weight.
Well, that's interesting. I've been drinking green tea every day for the last 9 months.
There you go.
But I'm not losing weight.
Well, you may have maxed out on the benefit, Tom.
Must be. Okay, so fiber, green tea.
And then something called pyruvate. And pyruvate is spelled P-Y-R-U-V-A-T-E.
It sounds like somebody who sets buildings on fire.
That's a little bit different process. Yeah. This is something that sets the calories on fire inside your body. And it will help you lose weight. Just by taking the compound, you can take it in a tablet form or powder form. A lot of bodybuilders will use this as a trick to thin up before a competition.
Interesting.
And again, it has to be coupled with a good diet and with exercise.
Yeah. Okay, Dr. Sky, last question. What do you see as the, you know, what are the politics of the vitamin industry right now? I keep hearing talk about supplements are going to be, you know, the pharmaceutical companies are going to get their way and make supplements illegal.
The big
we have
problem,
1 minute, by the way, to go, Scott.
Well, you're absolutely right that we've got a problem with every few years the Congress or the Senate turn their eyes on the vitamin industry. I think they've got bigger fish to fry, but this is the one that they like to look at. They always do it around the issue of safety and whether people are smart enough to make their own self-care and healthcare decisions. And it really is something that we need to keep an eye on because the industry is well regulated now. There's these good manufacturing practices that the companies are having to put into place. But there's a couple of bills that are going to be introduced this coming year, which will try to limit access. And again, it'll be under the guise of safety, that we don't want people to get hurt, so we're going to take some of these things off of the market.
I think it's ironic that Orrin Hatch is one of the guys who leads the charge in defense of vitamins and herbs, probably because he's from Utah and there's a lot of Mormons who are into this stuff.
That's part of it, but also the philosophy is that if you give people choice, then you create more options for people.
Yeah, yeah, and a wise one. Dr. Sky Leininger, thanks so much, Sky, for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Great talking with you. Oh, healthnotes.com, by the way, Sky's website, healthnotes.com. It's 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
But we shall also do our part to build a world of peace where the weak are safe and the strong are just. We are not helpless before that task or hopeless of its success. Confident and unafraid, we must labor on, not towards a strategy of annihilation, but towards a strategy of peace.
I say finally that I oppose the war in Vietnam because I love America.
With skillful manipulating of the press, they're able to make the victim look like the criminal and the criminal look like the victim. Right now in New York, we had a couple cases where police grabbed the brother and beat him unmercifully, then charged him with assault and death. They use the press to make it look like he's the criminal and they're the victim. This is how they do it. And if you say how they do it here, then you'll know how they do it over here. It's the same game going all the time. And if you and I don't awaken and see what this man is doing to us, then it'll be too late.
And welcome back, my friends. 35 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The Bush administration's Medicare prescription drug benefit, not quite the seamless transition that they thought it would be. Mark McClellan, the Medicare administrator, had promised. In fact, the Miami Herald ran an editorial calling it an unmitigated disaster, Miami having a disproportionate number of people on Medicare among their citizens. So what does the Bush administration do? Well, here it is. President Bush's top health advisors will fan out across the country this week to quell rising discontent with a new Medicare prescription drug benefit that has tens of thousands of elderly and disabled Americans, their pharmacists, and governors struggling to resolve myriad startup problems. You get this? You got a couple of hundred thousand people who have fallen through the cracks, can't get enrolled, can't figure out how the millions who can't figure out how this thing works. 20 states have had to step in and bridge people who suddenly, you know, they can't get their pharmaceuticals paid for, elderly people. 20 states have had to step in. The Bush's response to this, a PR campaign. Are they going to solve the problem? No, they are launching a public relations campaign. Are we surprised? Tragically, no. I just want to wrap up some of this economic stuff, and then we're going to take a couple of your phone calls here. 43% of first-time home buyers are now putting no money down. This number 15, 20 years ago was like around 3%. I mean, it's just very, very few people. A decade or two decades ago were buying homes with no money down. Very few people could. But now 43% in the last year of first-time homebuyers put no money down. What does that mean? That means that if the bubble pops and the value of the houses starts to decline, that people are going to owe more money on their house than their house is worth, and they have none of their own money tied up in that, and so they have an incentive to simply walk away from it. When they walk away from it, the bank goes down. The mortgage company goes down. And when that happens, then we're back with the S&L crisis that happened during the last Bush administration, the Bush elder administration, which made Neil Bush, Silverado savings loan, quite wealthy, by the way. You have the federal government coming in and saying, well, we will bail you out, which means you and I are paying for it. Dean Baker of the Center for Economic and Policy Research says that if housing prices fall at least 10%, it could be even more damaging than the collapse of the high-tech stock bubble in 2000. Why? Because the only thing that's been maintaining the economy for the last 5 years is the fact that just before the election of 2004, well, for a couple of years, actually, the 2 years before 2004, Alan Greenspan pushed interest rates down so low so George W. Bush could get himself reelected. Which he still didn't do, in my opinion, by the way. I still believe the exit polls, but that's a whole other thing. And so all of a sudden, you know, home mortgage monthly payments went down because interest rates went down, and so people were refinancing their homes. You saw all these ads popping up on TV. Hey, refi now. People taking money out of their homes. And if that bubble bursts, number one, consumers aren't going to have access to that cash anymore, and that's what's been keeping the economy alive. So it could flip us into something resembling a depression. And number two, we could have a banking crisis. Meanwhile, inflation, 3.4% this year, just reported, the worst in 5 years. Inflation rate hit its fastest pace in 5 years in 2005. This is from Barbara Hannenbaugh at USA Today. As the higher costs for energy, housing, education, and medical care drove up prices. By the way, average weekly earnings for hourly employees, they were up 2.8% last year. Inflation, 3.4%. Let's see, 8, 9, 10, 11. That's 6-tenths of a point. That means that if your wages went up 2.8%, which was the average, inflation went up 3.4%. You are now 0.6% behind where you were a year ago. Why don't the Democrats start using Ronald Reagan's line of, are you better off now than you were 4 years ago? I don't get it. And then on top of this, we have Beijing. Beijing is sitting on a pile of money. $818.9 billion in foreign reserves this year at the end of December, up from $769 billion at the end of September and $610 billion a year earlier. You see how quickly this is going up? Between 70 and 80% of its U.S. dollars. The only reason that this government, that George W. Bush, is able to make this economy look like it's working is because we are borrowing $2 billion a day to keep the government running and to make the economy look like it's working. And then taking that money and dumping it into the economy, much of it in the form of military spending. But now with the transportation bill, you know, building roads and whatnot. But it's all borrowed money. And the Chinese are starting to say, you know, we're not sure we want to hold all these dollars anymore. They're getting this, by the way, not because we're borrowing money. They're getting this because of the trade surplus, because we're buying more from them than we're selling to them. Cumulative trade surplus between the U.S. and China, $170 billion last year. This is according to an article in the New Zealand Herald. They note that the European Commission told its governments that China might invest more of its reserves in other currencies, putting pressure on the U.S. dollar. This is the European Commission, the official, the EU, the EC of the EU, saying there have been indications that China could begin to diversify foreign exchange reserves away from U.S. dollar assets, something that could put downward pressure on the U.S. dollar. In other words, sell your dollars. Now, what does that mean for you and me? It means that in all probability, the price of gold is going to go through the roof. Oil is going to continue to go up. Inflation is going to get worse. It's going to be more expensive for this government to borrow money, which means that the interest that we're paying on the $8 trillion national debt that George Bush has given us about half of, and Ronald Reagan gave us about half of, when he borrowed money like crazy to try and make the economy look like it was doing okay. I mean, I'm telling you, you give me a credit card with a $1 million line of credit that I don't have to pay, my grandchildren are going to pay, and I could show you what it looks like to live large. That's exactly what Reagan and Bush have done. And it's wrong. It's morally wrong. It's economically wrong. It is insane. They're driving us right up against the edge. And it's wrong. And I don't know how many times I have to say it, but it's like, you know, the next time somebody says, oh, the economy is great. Yeah, if you borrow $2 billion a day and you spend that money, you can make it look like things are pretty good. And they're really not even that good. Because if you're a wage earner, you're making 0.6% less than you were a year ago. Armin in Bradenton, Florida. Hey, Armin, welcome to the program.
I could comment on that, but I don't want to take up my time. I want to ask you something else.
Okay.
I think I know what Bush is doing, and I think a lot of people that think a lot know what he's doing. He's trying to pacify his extreme loyalists. What he thinks is he's got them convinced that China's going to go with him. They're going to implement PNAC in the Mideast. They're going to put Israel in its place, shove out the Rothschilds, go to their own monetary system, and everything's going to be heaven and free. But that's not what that little lowlife's going to end up doing, because he'd sell his mother out for a buck.
And
you know what's going to happen.
And it may have, actually. I was reading Kitty Kelly's book yesterday. Wow, I got to tell you. But anyhow, as you were saying, yeah.
Anyway, there's a rumor. Oh, back to that judge. Quickly, they don't want any activist judges unless they're corporate activists.
There you go.
And this is what corporate feudalism is about. But anyway, I heard a rumor, I can't confirm it or deny it, that maybe you can help me, that McDonald's is going to divert attention from the Bush crime family's jam that they're currently in by coming up with a scary meal. And it's going to be for adults to keep them in a constant, you know, state of fear.
Well, along with your burger, you get an audio tape of Osama bin Laden saying, you know, the Democrats are saying to pull out of Iraq, and I'm saying to pull out of Iraq. Therefore, who are you going to vote for?
Well, they're going to have cups with Osama on them that says, wanted, wanted, wanted. And then they're going to have all the sandwiches packaged up with Taliban camps.
Yeah.
So then when you eat the sandwich, you get to wad the camp up and throw it in the trash.
Yeah.
So they feel like they've contributed.
Okay. Well, good one, Armin. Good one. I'm sorry. I don't even think McDonald's is that off the edge. But you're right about Bush.
It's an impressive crowd, the haves and the have-mores. Some people call you the elite. I call you my base.
Yes, indeed. Some people call you the elite. I call you my base. We should just listen. Just listen to his words. 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman here with you on the True People's Radio.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Hang on tight to your dreams, my friends. There you go. Welcome back. Truth at Common Sense in Broadcasting for a change. Yeah, to change America. Yes, it's a double entendre and well meant. 1-866-440-8466, a telephone number. Rick in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Rick, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. You know, that judge's comment just infuriated me so much that you can't go against the tide of the marketplace.
Yeah, isn't that mind-boggling? And then on the other hand, you've got a company that is Southwest, the most heavily unionized airline in the business, so it's got the happiest employees, so they treat their customers well, so their customers keep coming back, so the company's profitable, and all these other companies are screwing their employees, and they're wondering why their customers are going away.
Well, and here's the thing. That brought back the metaphor of Atlas Shrugged. In the case of Atlas Shrugged, the bad corporation abuses government power to gain competitive advantage.
Right.
And the good corporation, John Galt, goes against the tide of the marketplace. Who in this case is John Galt?
Yeah, well, it's Southwest.
Okay.
Yeah.
Macy, and what's wrong with this picture? Well, why don't people see it? Why can't we wake them up?
And why don't the folks from the Ayn Rand Institute see it?
Yeah, why don't the Ayn Rand, the Randyland? You ought to see, there's a great poem called Randyland.
Yeah.
Where a guy describes the world that the Randyland people, as he calls them, sees.
Well, I think actually they're probably more wed to Ayn Rand's essay on the virtue of selfishness than to Atlas Shrugged, although Atlas Shrugged was probably her most well-known, certainly her most well-known novel. But good point, Rick, and an interesting one. Thank you very much for the call.
Okay.
Good to hear from you. Kate in Tacoma. Hey, Kate, what's up?
Good morning, and thank you. I wanted to revisit your comment on the Republicans and Bin Laden, and also make a comment on the global warming issue.
Mm-hmm.
The very first videotape that Bin Laden released after September 11th, I don't know if people remember, he was sitting around talking about the attack and how surprised he was that the buildings came down, but he said something when I read it on the translation that just made my blood run cold, and I can't believe that nobody is bringing it up. I don't know if they've refined, quote-unquote, the translation, but he said, human rights and dignity are dead in America. Their government will now lead them down the road to hell. And nobody is using that, and it plays right in with everything you've been talking about this morning.
Well, I've been saying, you know, from the week after 9/11, in fact, there was an instant book that came out called From the Ashes, A Spiritual Response to the Attacks of 9/11. It's published by Rodale, and it's still in print. You can find it out there.
Okay.
And there was 20-some of us that wrote chapters. I wrote a chapter for it. Billy Graham wrote a chapter for it. The Pope's office submitted a chapter on his over his name. The Dalai Lama wrote a chapter. A whole bunch of folks who were, you know, whatever. I mean, people with much better credentials than me. I was very honored to be invited. And the argument that I made in the piece that I wrote for that was that this could be an opportunity for us to create reconciliation between religions, and this could be an opportunity for us to bring the world together in a positive way, or it could be an opportunity for hate and division to reign, and we must be very careful about the choices that we make. And, of course, that book was published before George Bush became public about the fact that, you know, he was going to go to war and all this.
Exactly.
But what Bush did was, in many ways, by refusing to negotiate with the Taliban to take Bin Laden, because they offered to give him Bin Laden. They didn't offer to give. They said that they would give Bin Laden to a third party country, somebody other than the United States, where he'd get a fair trial. And Bush said no. You know, we're gonna bomb you. You know, rule of law.
A carpet of bombs.
That goes back to the old Unocal, to Hamid Karzai back before 9/11, before the Bush administration even.
Exactly.
And what Bush did was just an absolute gift to Osama bin Laden. There's just no way around it.
He couldn't have done it any better.
Yeah, Kate, I got to move along. I got a bunch of other callers.
Could I make my comment on global warming?
If it's quick.
It is quick. Whether it's man-made or whether it's natural, it's here. There's no debate. It's a moot point. We need to understand and figure out how to adapt and possibly mitigate the adverse effects.
I agree. Thank you very much, Kate. Dale in Kearney, Nebraska. Hey, Dale.
Tom, how are you?
I am great. What's up?
Well, I've been a long-time listener, and I've never really been active politically until I started listening to your radio show, and I've been calling my wonderful Democratic Senator Ben Nelson on almost every issue that's been discussed, and I feel like it falls on deaf ears. Nothing changes. So I'm headed to my first Democratic meeting here tonight.
Oh, good on you, Dale.
And I guess if I can't get change through the phone call to these people, then have to get active, right?
Yeah, exactly. Ben Nelson is the first Democrat who has come out and said that he's going to vote in favor of Alito, which is tragic. And
amazing. It really is. I call him a Republican in a Democratic coat.
Yeah, or they're referring them to them now as dinos, you know, Democrat in name only.
Yes.
You know,
another thing that troubles me is with this Maryland case on Walmart, I've tried to visit with some of the labor people here in our own big box stores, which they're putting up everywhere here in the Midwest.
Sure.
And the mindset of those people just astounds me. They seem pleased to be making these minimum wages.
Yeah, and they don't realize that it is tipping the economy. Walmart is established, and not just Walmart. I mean, Walmart is part of a larger gestalt or zeitgeist or whatever the right German word is.
Absolutely.
It's part of a much larger thing of just basically the dragging down of the American economy, the pouring down of America. Anyhow, coming up on the next Tom Hartman program, Brunch with Bernie Sanders. Tomorrow, Larry Johnson on the arrogance of Jerry Bremer, Jeffrey Kleinman on the latest independent films, that and your calls right here tomorrow. Remember, activism starts with you, my friends. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.